Ms. O'Leary.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dawn O'Leary. I represent Jerrica King and her mother and next friend, Bernice King, against the East St. Louis School District. This is a case about affirmative acts and about what constitutes an affirmative act that leads to liability under Section 1983 for a state-created danger. In the case below, the District Court granted summary judgment to the East St. Louis School District on two grounds. On one ground, it found that we presented no evidence of a policy as required by Monell, which would lead to school district liability. The court also found that there was no evidence of an affirmative act by the East St. Louis School District, which would create liability for a state-created danger. At the same time the court granted summary judgment to the East St. Louis School District, the court denied our motion for leave to amend the complaint to add Frank Knave, Jerrica's school counselor, as a defendant, finding that Mr. Knave did not commit an affirmative act, which would lead to liability for a state-created danger under 1983. In this case, we believe that there's plenty of evidence that there's been an affirmative act.
Talking about the state of the record, tell me what kind of discovery took place in this case? I mean, there seemed to be an awful lot of unanswered questions that one would presume would be answered in discovery, like who was guarding the door. I mean, did you ever ask anybody about that in discovery?
Yes, Your Honor. The posture of this case was that we had previously filed the case and then voluntarily dismissed it. Some discovery was conducted prior to the voluntary dismissal, including the depositions of the school superintendent, the school principal, Mrs. King, and Jerrica. There were a handful of depositions taken, and written discovery was exchanged, and we exchanged our Rule 26 disclosures. We then dismissed the case and refiled it because we were having a problem with locating a school security expert. Immediately upon refiling, the defendant filed a motion to dismiss / motion for summary judgment, a combined motion, and it's on that motion that we were...
Well, did you ask the district court if you could have more discovery?
Yes, we did, Your Honor, in our written motion, but it was not granted.
Did he deny it?
Yes, they did.
He did deny additional discovery?
Yes. And the answer
to... Are you appealing on that ground?
No, we're not, Your Honor.
Because you don't know who was guarding the door. Did you ask for production of any policy about not being able to come back into the school?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. And the answer we got from the school district that there was no written policy. With regard to who was guarding the door, our understanding from written discovery and from the depositions of the school principal and the school superintendent was that there was a unarmed security guard on duty during school hours, but they had left at that time. There was a school administrator who was on duty in the building who is currently unidentified. We don't know her name, and there were three that rotated.
See, that's what's puzzling me. I mean, why couldn't you have found out through discovery who that person was?
We simply didn't have time, Your Honor. We were looking for previously filed case, we were looking for a school policy, and then at the time that the motion for summary judgment was granted, we simply didn't have time to find her name. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. No, I thought you had finished. You complete your answer.
I'm fine, Your Honor.
Clear up for me this question of what was said after this counseling session. You say somewhere here that she...
It's the school counselor.
That she told him, I missed my bus and I have to call my mother.
Yes. And then she left the building.
Why would she have left the building if, in fact, that conversation had actually taken place?
There were
phones available and she certainly could have used one.
Yes, Your Honor. There were three ways that Jerrica traveled to and from school. One was the yellow bus, the school bus. She sometimes walked with friends upon two or three occasions. The other way she could have gotten home safely was to take a city bus. Bi-State Transportation serves the East St. Louis School District, and she could have taken a city bus from the school to her home. So what she did is she left the building, went outside the building, looked to see if there was a city bus available. There wasn't one available. She then tried to re-enter the building to use the phone and was turned away by...
Well, but the other side says that, you know, that really didn't happen, that... She never mentioned to Mr. Knave that she had to make a telephone call. And it just seems odd that if she knew she had to make a telephone call, why she would have left the school.
Your Honor, she's 15. She understands that she doesn't have that she's missed her school bus and she can't walk home with her friends, but she thought perhaps she could take the bus. And as far as what the other side says about that, this was a motion for summary judgment. We have evidence in the plaintiff's deposition that that's what she told Mr. Knave. We haven't taken Mr. Knave's deposition. We have an affidavit from him. But all reasonable inferences and all findings of fact have to go in favor of the non-moving party. So at this point, at this stage of the litigation, we have to assume that it is as Jerrica said, that she told her school counselor, I missed my bus, I need to call my mother. He then allowed her to leave the building without calling her mother. She looked out, saw that no city bus was available, and then tried to reenter the school building, and an unidentified school employee told her she couldn't come in to use the phone. At any rate, that after-hours school counseling session that we've just been discussing is an affirmative action which leads to liability for state-created danger under 1983.
Yeah, on appeal here, you seem to be proceeding exclusively on that theory, although your complaint talked about a special relationship. Am I correct in assuming you are proceeding simply on the theory of state-created danger?
Yes, Your Honor. We are only pursuing the state-created danger theory. When we filed the complaint, we examined both the custodial relationship exception to DeShaney and the state-created danger exception to DeShaney. Having examined the case law more thoroughly now, it is our opinion that only the state-created danger theory applies to this case.
I see.
Counsel, why would there be a state-created danger here but not in DeShaney? Your argument, as I understand it, seems to be that if the state takes any affirmative act, that's the same as a state-created danger. But there were, of course, affirmative acts in DeShaney, such as allowing Joshua back into his father's custody.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why would there be no liability in DeShaney, but liability here? We know, you see what I'm getting at? The minimum understanding of DeShaney is that an affirmative act is not enough for liability, because otherwise DeShaney comes out the other way.
Your Honor, in DeShaney, what the Supreme Court said is that the danger was created by this third person and that following the law, the Winnebago County Social Services had no duty other than to return Joshua to his father and had no reason to foresee that there was any additional danger to Joshua from his father. In cases developed by this circuit, though, the case law of state-created danger has been developed much further than it was in DeShaney. DeShaney, the state-created danger exception is sort of...
I think you should say, gee, Seventh Circuit, you've contradicted DeShaney. My question is not about other cases.
Yes.
My question is how your position can be reconciled with DeShaney itself, since we know from DeShaney that an affirmative act is not enough for liability. Now, can you distinguish your case from DeShaney? The problem in DeShaney was that the father caused the harm, and the problem here is that some stranger caused the harm.
Your Honor,
they failed to protect your client, just as the state failed to protect Joshua.
The difference between this case and DeShaney is the same as the difference between this case and Reed versus Gardner. In Reed versus Gardner, this circuit framed the question as whether state intervention caused a condition that would cause any additional harm. In DeShaney, if the state had not intervened, Joshua would have still been in danger. In Reed versus Gardner, if the state had not intervened, the victims in that case would have still been in danger from the drunk driver. There is a difference between cases in which you are talking about was the danger any greater if the state intervenes or doesn't intervene versus does the state intervention cause an additional risk of harm? In this case, different from DeShaney, Joshua would have been at risk no matter what the state did. If the state could have easily left him there with his father could have murdered the boy, and the state would have had no liability. The state intervention doesn't alter the danger. In this case, the state intervention does alter the danger because what it does is it prevents Jerrica King from taking actions to protect herself. She could have walked home with friends. She could have ridden the city bus. She could have ridden the school bus. But by meeting with her at the end of the school day, the school is stopping her from doing that.
But she voluntarily went to this meeting. This wasn't an arranged meeting, was it?
No, what happened is she stopped at the end of the school day to ask about her credits towards graduation. At that point, Frank Knave asked her about a conflict she was having with another student, and then initiated a longer counseling session regarding this conflict that he was concerned about. In Reed versus Gardner, this court framed the question about increased danger and the difference between Reed versus Gardner and DeShaney, and this case in DeShaney, as whether the increased danger, whether the state, by taking an action that's either recklessly indifferent or grossly negligent, increased danger to the individual. And with that, I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Leary. Mr. Horner.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Garrett Horner of the law firm of Becker, Paulson, Horner & Thompson. I represent defendants, appellants, or appellees, East St. Louis School District Number 189, Dr. Nathaniel Anderson, and Dr. Chester Blouette. I'd like to begin this morning by addressing a few of the questions that were raised during appellant's initial argument. The first is related to the discovery that was conducted in this case. As counsel indicated, this case was previously filed and ultimately voluntarily dismissed. The motion for voluntary dismissal was filed after discovery had been completed. It was filed 5 days after the close of discovery in the initial case. The problems that she cited related to an expert may have been associated with the fact that the expert disclosure deadline had passed. But nevertheless, at the time that the motion for voluntary dismissal was granted, we had already filed an identical motion for summary judgment that had been pending. Upon her...
In the earlier case?
Yes. And the court granted the motion to voluntarily dismiss and ultimately dismissed the case while that motion for summary judgment was pending. After counsel refiled the case on behalf of plaintiff, we filed a motion to dismiss under 12b-6 and attached all the identical material that we had attached to the earlier motion for summary judgment. And contrary to what counsel suggests, I think the record will indicate that there was no request for additional discovery at that time. In fact, Judge Murphy asked during the course of the hearing if she had had adequate notice, and the transcript will reflect this, and she agreed, and then in his decision, he noted that she conceded that she had adequate notice to introduce any necessary evidence in rebuttal. So as far as whether or not discovery had been completed and whether or not there was a request for additional discovery, I think the record contains indications contrary to what counsel suggests.
Mr. Horner, with respect to the existence or non-existence of this policy against reentry, why isn't there a genuine issue of triable fact on this? It seems one of the school officials testified that there was a policy, but it involved, in effect, hanging out in the school. Mr. Navy, he at one point apparently indicated that there was a policy. Seems that this is at least in play, isn't it?
Judge, with respect to the policy, we introduced at summary judgment the deposition of Dr. Nathaniel Anderson, the deposition of Dr. Chester Blouette. We introduced the affidavit of Administrator Lee Triefenbach, the affidavit of school counselor Frank Knave, all of which confirm that no such policy existed. Actually, when faced with that, Judge Murphy at the hearing asked plaintiff, what, if anything, do you have to rebut this? And as I indicated in my brief, plaintiff's response was merely that all they had was the statements of this unidentified woman who allegedly had prevented plaintiff's minor from entering the building. Then on appeal, these other arguments were made with respect to that, but I would suggest, as I did in my brief, that if a full reading of Chester Blouette's deposition will indicate that there is no policy that prevents someone from reentering for purposes such as this or to obtain a book or something that was left behind.
And we have that one policy of one statement of Mr. Knave about the fact that it's just against policy for them to enter, right?
No, that was actually a a statement that came in Bernice King, plaintiff's deposition, that she claims that Mr. Nave had indicated that to her. But if a full reading of her statement, of Mr. Nave's hearsay statement, indicates that Mr. Nave explicitly told her that it was not a policy of the school district. Those were his words, not a policy. So I think that the district court correctly found that there is no policy or practice in East St. Louis School District number 189 that would prevent students from reentering the building to use the telephones after school, and also with respect to the alleged policy or practice permitting school employees to require students to stay after school. With respect to that policy, counsel suggests that although Jerrica had voluntarily attended this counseling session and had gone in without appointment or any instruction to do so, that Mr. Nave somehow extended it, thereby making that some affirmative act. There's no evidence in the record that suggests that. I mean, she admitted, Jerrica admitted, her mother admitted that it was a voluntary act on her part to go seek Mr. Nave's counseling, and so there's no support in the record for that allegation. In fact, I believe during the course of that deposition, counsel had indicated that they were going to go away from that theory, and this is in the first case, and those depositions are contained in the record.
Does the record tell us how many students ordinarily just walk home from school?
No, it does not.
Is there a significant number?
I think that Judge Murphy did identify or did indicate that you know kids walk home from school all the time, but the only evidence in the record that concerning Jerrica was that she had previously walked home once before with two friends.
Yeah, but that's not much. I mean, she's a sophomore in high school. If they only walked home once or twice from school. I mean, is it this dangerous to walk home from this school?
Your Honor, I would take the position that it's not. There has been no evidence put forth by the plaintiff as to the criminal activity at or near the school. There's just no evidence to support that.
St. Louis?
Pardon me?
Isn't it enough that this was East St. Louis? What more evidence does she need?
I don't believe that we could take judicial notice of that.
Can't we?
Your Honor, I would.
All you have to do is look at the data on the crime rate in East St. Louis.
But I believe that is evidence that she is required to put forth to make her case, and the evidence is devoid of it.
These are public figures. You can look them up on the FBI's website, the kind of thing you get out of the statistical abstract.
But I believe that, Your Honor, that is evidence that is incumbent upon the plaintiff to put forth. And there has been no evidence that's in the record as to criminal activity with respect to that area.
Mr. Horner, I'm a bit concerned with the possibility here that your clients really cut off whatever means she had to protect herself here. She was entitled to school bus transportation to keep her safe. Apparently there was even an activities bus that came along later to pick up stragglers so they wouldn't be exposed to the elements of having to walk home unprotected. So clearly the authorities thought they had obligations to keep these children safe between the school and their home. Here, when she obviously couldn't afford herself for the usual means of getting home, she attempted to do something about it. The state just simply cut off her escape, if you want, from danger. Why is that analysis incorrect?
In this instance, Your Honor, the district offered her, and there's no dispute that she was offered the school bus transportation that she was offered every day. It was by her own actions that she missed that opportunity. And when she was in the counselor's office, it's her testimony at deposition that when she was in the counselor's office, she had realized that she had missed the school bus. I asked her if at that time did she understand that she had the opportunity to use the phones in the counselor's office if she wanted to make a call. She responded yes. I inquired about her access at that point while still in the building to the principal's office, another telephone source. She confirmed that.
Of course, at that time, she still had one of the safe sources available, or so she thought, the city bus. She tried that. That was her first attempt at self-help. It didn't work. She came back and tried to get back into the school to take the next step, and that's where the problem arose, right?
No, Your Honor. Actually, the record will indicate that she was in the counselor's office when she realized what time it was, and she realized that she had already missed that school bus. She indicated in her deposition testimony that the reason why she did not...
She hadn't missed the city bus yet, though, right? She didn't know she had missed the city bus. She went out and looked for it.
Well, the city bus is a bus that comes periodically. I think it's, whatever the Metro provides every 10 minutes.
Does the record indicate where that bus stopped in relation to the school?
The record indicates that that the bus does, based upon her deposition, the bus stops immediately in front of the school, the city bus.
Mm-hmm.
But she was walking toward another bus station that's roughly three blocks behind the school in another direction. So the record does indicate that the city bus stop is immediately in front of the school.
Could you clarify one other point in the record for me, please? This activities bus, the bus that picked up the children who were staying for extracurricular activities, had that left at the time?
That I don't know. I think that there was some reference to an activities bus, but not on a daily basis. It depends on what activities are off of the high school campus.
So the record doesn't show that there was still a school bus to come or something. The record doesn't affirmatively show that.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But again, I would suggest that, that during the time that Ms. King was in the counselor's office, she realized that she had missed the bus. She admitted she had opportunity to use the telephone, and she affirmatively stated that the reason why she did not use the telephone was because she knew that her mother would be unable to pick her up. Yet she then exited the building and claims to have walked around in an attempt to use the phone. So I think that those contradictions belie her story and the fact that the woman who she claims had prevented her access to the building had ultimately has never been identified during the course of discovery or otherwise. And so at this point, that person is not a party at any rate. While plaintiff assumes that it's a school employee, that hasn't been proven. But of course, even if for the sake of argument it was a school employee, there's no respondeat superior 1983 liability for the district. So in the absence of a policy or practice with the district, there can be no 1983 liability for the district. And in the obvious absence of any personal involvement on the part of Dr. Anderson and Dr. Blouette, there can be no individual liability for either of those two gentlemen. And counsel's brief, plaintiff appellant's brief, acknowledges as much in that it now claims that under the law, personal involvement is required only for individual liability and suggests that they're proceeding under official capacity liability, which, again, is a duplicative of count one against the district and would encounter the same fate that count one did. And that's summary judgment based upon a lack of a policy or practice. Finally, with respect to plaintiff's alternative claims that the district failed to institute proper policies or properly train or supervise its employees because summary judgment was appropriate there because there, again, is no evidence of deliberate indifference on the district's part, and that is what the district court properly found. Nor can the district be liable for such a theory if plaintiff fails to prove that the individual officers are liable on the underlying substantive claim. And again, because the individual officers cannot be liable in the face of a lack of personal involvement, there can be no claim against the district for a failure to train. Finally, with respect to plaintiff's motion for leave to file First Amendment complaint, the district court properly denied that because the proposed amendment was futile and that Mr. Nave did not create a danger such that 1983 liability will attach. The district court properly look to the fact that Mr. Nabe did not schedule or otherwise instruct the plaintiff to be there. The plaintiff's minor simply went in voluntarily to visit with Mr. Nabe on her own accord. And such a denial by the district court is consistent with this court's stance on futile amendments. For these reasons and those stated in the brief, defendants East St. Louis School District No. 189, Dr. Nathaniel Anderson and Dr. Chester Blewett, respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's summary judgment on plaintiff's complaint in defendant's favor and against plaintiff, and affirm the district court's denial of plaintiff's motion for leave to file First Amendment complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. Anything further, Ms. O'Leary?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, with regard to the discovery issue, I believe that I did indicate in my response to the motion to dismiss / motion for summary judgment that we need that a motion to dismiss was premature and that we needed more evidence. Whatever the record says, the record says. I believe I did ask for that. It'll be in the pleadings if I did or did not.
The technical question is whether you filed an affidavit under Rule 56F.
No, I did not. I did not. With regard to a fact question that Your Honor, Judge Ripple had a moment ago, the way that the facts of Jerrica leaving the school building went was this. Jerrica, the East St. Louis School District High School day in sometimes before 3 o'clock, she stopped to ask about her credits, got into this conversation with Mr. Nave about this conflict she was having with another student. That concluded about 3:40. She told him at that time that she had missed her bus, that she probably needed to call her mother. She left the building, walked outside of the building to see if the bus that was across the street was there. It was not there. She then tried to re-enter the building to use the telephone, was denied entrance by this unidentified woman that we're inferring was the school administrator who's there till 5:30. Jerrica described the woman as dressed like a teacher, but she couldn't identify her, which to me says it was the school administrator, but we haven't identified her yet. Jerrica then tried to walk home. As she was walking home, when she approached the Washington Park Metrolink station, which is a light rail station / bus station about 2 blocks from the school, that's when she was abducted at gunpoint. The school district has relied very heavily on the idea that Jerrica's voluntarily stopping at the school counselor's office somehow absolves the school district of liability. But there are various cases where all sorts of voluntary activity does not remove the state's liability for state-created danger. In the Third Circuit, the case versus Tedder involves a drunk pedestrian where a woman got drunk at a bar. Her husband was attempting to walk her home. She was voluntarily walking home, and she was voluntarily intoxicated. The police stopped the woman and her husband to question them, to find out what they were doing. They were causing a disturbance in the street. The police sent the husband home, stayed there talking with this drunk woman. They then decided not to arrest her, left her standing on the sidewalk, and she proceeded to fall down an embankment. Now, all of her activities in that case were voluntary, but that goes to her contributory negligence. It doesn't go to whether or not the state's liable. She was voluntarily walking on the street, voluntarily drunk, but that doesn't absolve the state of their danger not to increase the circumstances that are going to cause her injury. And in that case, the Third Circuit said that the act of stopping her on the street and sending her assistance, her husband, home, was the affirmative act by the state that created a danger. In its briefs, the school district also relies very heavily on a case from the circuit called Martin versus Shawano Gresham School District, in which a student, after being suspended from school, was sent home by the school principal and committed suicide. In that case, this circuit found that there was no liability for the school district. But one thing that we point out in our briefs, but I'd also like to point out now, is that Martin is distinguishable from this case for two reasons. One, in that case, the student was sent home as normal at the end of the day. And that's different from this case where Mr. Nave met with her for an extended period of time after hours rather than stopping her. He certainly could have told her that, go home, I'll talk to you tomorrow. The other problem that distinguishes this case from the Martin case is that in the Martin case, there was no reasonable foreseeability that the student would commit suicide. There was no indication to the school principal that she was depressed or that she had suicide on her mind. It was sort of a random act. In this case, the East St. Louis High School is in an extremely dangerous neighborhood. The danger of third-party criminal actions against students is extremely foreseeable. And in fact, in their depositions, that is why the school district admitted that they have security guards on campus during the day to keep outsiders from coming into the school.
But of course, arguments like that are what get me to worry about DeShaney. The whole reason for the Department of Family Services in Illinois is to protect the Joshuas of the world from being beaten. If there weren't a risk,
yes,
that wouldn't exist. And the problem in DeShaney, problem for you in DeShaney, is the Supreme Court's holding that the state's failure to protect somebody from a known risk, even if there's a whole state bureaucracy devoted to trying to protect people from that risk, the state's failure to protect people from known risks does not create a constitutional tort.
Your Honor, what the Supreme Court says in DeShaney is that the state does not guarantee the rights of individuals. But in other cases, once the state does intervene, they have a duty to do so.
Did intervene in DeShaney. Joshua was taken from his father and then returned to him.
Right, but it's framed in the same way that Reed versus Gardner is if absent state intervention, would the danger have been any different? And in DeShaney, the answer is no. Here, the intervention is what creates the danger, as opposed to no intervention.
The state did not create the rapist. That's the source of the danger.
The state did stop her from walking home and helping herself, however.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel.
Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.